Hello, good afternoon, and a very warm welcome to today's episode of Resounding Echoes. I would like to start today with a little news. I became aware just after last week's program of a new book that should be of interest to anyone listening to this program. The book in question is called Suppressed Composers in the Netherlands, subtitled Forbidden Music in the Second World War. It has a foreword written by Michael Haas, whose own excellent book, Forbidden Music, should be known by anyone interested not only in music but also modern history. And I feel everyone has a duty to know their history, which is a matter for another day. The book, Suppressed Composers in the Netherlands, is published by Toccata Press, and it is literally hot off the press. Now, I have not read it, so I can't say anything positive or negative about it, but I am more than happy to recommend or to make known its existence, just in case anybody out there is not aware of it. Okay, so let's get back to today's program. Now, last week I played Scriabin's fourth piano sonata as an example of a composer at the beginning of the last century toying with tonality. And today I'm going to start with another somewhat more substantial piece in that vein. Well, I'm going to start and I'm going to concentrate on this piece for most of today's program. Now, one of the undeniably great assets of tonality is that its system of related keys is a great way to develop thematic and harmonic ideas. You can think of development in music as akin to evolution in nature. It is the very means by which a piece is sustained, grows, mutates, and becomes something new and fascinating for anything that aspires to be more than merely throwaway. Staying with the analogy of evolution, you can consider the most banal of popular music as the equivalent of cloned music. And in saying that, I don't wish to imply that all popular music is banal, far from it. However, for new and fascinating musical species to proliferate, you need development. Now, all music at root is a mixture to varying degrees of two basic and simple principles, namely variation and repetition. The most vacuous of popular music is dependent on an overwhelming, often intolerable amount of repetition. Whereas, on the other hand, much 20th century music contains so much variation and so little repetition that many listeners find it impossible to enjoy for the want of anything by which to get to grips with. They feel as if they are in free fall without a parachute, and tend to focus more on the panic-stricken lack of a parachute rather than abandoning themselves to the intense, joyous rush of the fall. On this point, allow me to indulge in one of my by now habitual digressions. I have heard many people remark when commenting on a particular piece of music, usually 20th century music, that they don't understand it. Anyone who says such a thing is missing the point entirely, as far as I'm concerned. Why? Because a piece of instrumental music is not something to be understood. It is not a set of instructions, a mathematical equation, nor a philosophical argument. It is music, and as such, it is meant first and foremost to be felt, not understood. If you study a score or speak with a composer, you may well understand a lot about the compositional process of a particular piece of music, and indeed acquire a greater appreciation and probably enjoyment of the piece based on such knowledge. But all this information is frankly useless, or at best secondary, if the piece doesn't make an instant impression on you solely as a visceral, emotional, intellectual listening experience. Now, you don't have to take my word for this, but I have heard composers of the caliber of no less than Yanis Xenakis and Robert Gerhard strenuously making this point. As I stated last week, music expresses nothing except music. It is a mistake to look for references or explanations to its meaning beyond the strictly musical. It's a similar story for people who stand in front of one of Mark Rothko's paintings, for example, and ask, what's it supposed to be? Well, it's not supposed to be anything. It is what it is, namely a painting, a created object with no reference to anything beyond itself. And that is where its magic lies. It is not a mirror or a portrait of something already existent. It is something new, self-referential, and as the brilliant Brazilian author Clarice Lispector once wrote, what is called abstract so often seems to me the figurative of a more delicate and difficult reality. And just to finish this digression, the idea that you can separate the emotional and the intellectual in any experience of art, for me, is an absolute nonsense. Talk of purely cerebral music just doesn't make any sense. It's just a meaningless statement, in my opinion. The senses, touch, sight, hearing, taste, vision, and how we experience and process the information they provide us with are wholly dependent on nerves, and the center of our nervous system is the brain. Surely that says enough. Why some people clearly want to separate the intellectual from the artistic experience to suffocate thinking, I find deeply suspicious and disconcerting, but that will have to wait for another day and another program. But anyway, back to repetition and variety. Too much repetition, as I said in music, is mind-numbingly minimal and indeed can become torture if listened to for an extended period of time. For this reason, variation is the key to music. And as I said, tonality is an excellent tool for creating variety, for extensively developing even extremely simple musical ideas. So the problem that many composers faced at the beginning of the last century, who felt that tonality was no longer sufficient to provide all the means that their musical ideas needed, was how do you compose extended pieces of music without tonality? How do you develop musical ideas if you are going to dispense with the gravitational framework of tradition? This problem bedeviled many composers for the first two decades and beyond of the 20th century, until new systems were invented that enabled the possibility of extended development to replace the scaffolding of tonality. But until then, the first 20 years or so of the last century witnessed many fascinating adventures as composers experimented with various ways and means of extending tonality before they ultimately, or some of them, ultimately set sail into a wholly unknown world, with no sense of direction, no knowledge of what lay ahead, not even a map, not even a compass. That is the opening of one of the earliest adventures in atonality of a sort, composed by exact contemporary of Charles Ives, Arno Schönberg, in 1906. It is his first of two chamber symphonies. It's a well-known piece, but one I have once again never had the opportunity or the good fortune to hear live. From the Steeples and the Mountains by Charles Ives, which I played 2 weeks ago, is an extraordinarily brave leap into the unknown. Maybe Ives, being as he was in New England, far from the heart of the classical music world, felt no compunction about discarding or even ridiculing tradition, but this was harder for those in Europe, especially for those born into the Germanic musical tradition, for whom the weight of the music of Bach, Mozart, Beethoven, Brahms and Wagner weighed very heavily indeed, almost with a moral force. It is no surprise, therefore, that their attempts at searching for a new land were somewhat more tentative or respectful of tradition. The Scriabin I played last week is in this vein, as is Schoenberg's First Chamber Symphony. It is a Janus-faced piece to a much greater extent than Scriabin's Fourth Piano Sonata. Its most fascinating aspect, arguably, for me, is its relationship with the past and how it broke new ground despite these ties with the world of yesterday. Right from the beginning, there are strange things happening here. The opening cadence you just heard sounds more like an ending than a beginning. I don't know if that's what Schoenberg intended it to sound like. Is he saying this is the end of something old and the beginning of something new? Furthermore, according to the score, the piece is in the key of E major, yet that opening resolves onto the key of F major, a very distant, indeed wrong key in traditional harmonic thinking. Much of the symphony is built around a juxtaposition and interplay of these two key centers to an extraordinarily resourceful extent, showing that ideas that are anathema to traditional harmonic thinking are perfectly adequate for sustained development, at least in the hands of a composer as gifted as Schoenberg. His use of counterpoint is also another way of loosening up the tug of tonality. For those of you who don't understand counterpoint, it basically just means playing two or more melodies or themes simultaneously. So it's a more, let's say, melodically based idea than harmonic. But of course it has harmonic implications, as any playing of two or more notes inevitably has to. But anyway, let's have a little more of this chamber symphony. Now, that opening of the symphony proper, after that initial introductory cadence, is also very unusual for being a sequence of rising forts. Now, forts, when I say that, I just mean it's all those notes are separated by the interval of a fourth, the distance between the notes. That's what intervals are. So each one is the same distance apart, and the distance in this case is a fourth. But forts, both melodically and harmonically, play an important role in this piece. This is also in sharp contrast to Western tradition, which most harmonic thinking is built around thirds. Thirds and harmonies built in them have a much greater sense of gravity about them. That theme of rising forts seems like it could go on forever. It is difficult to say which is the root note. Any note in that scale could be the root. And this gives Schoenberg a great freedom in choosing how to develop his ideas. With no root note in the theme, any note can serve as the root, and thus he can go in multiple limitless directions. Now here I think we can see the dawning of the idea of the equality of all notes without one necessarily dominating over all the rest. An idea that would have profound consequences in the years and decades to come. It provides a great sense of ambiguity and uncertainty and freedom. Wagner had used forts in the opening of Tristan und Isolde, but Schoenberg here goes much further. There is an incredible wealth of invention in this work, a sign of the respect Schoenberg shows for any respectful listener. So much so that it can sometimes be hard to follow it all, but that sequence of rising forts is repeated like a Wagnerian leitmotif throughout the piece as a signpost. Let's listen to it in a slightly different guise. Now, that is from that's the beginning of the Adagio, which brings us to another remarkable aspect of this work. It is a symphony in one movement. But Schoenberg is already such a master of compositional thinking and so unique this early in his career that he is able to include a traditional four-movement symphonic structure within the bounds of a single movement. This adagio is not a separate movement, but a seamless part of the development of the original ideas included within the single movement form, a form which Schoenberg would use again and again throughout his life. Another important feature evident here and pertinent for future development in orchestral composition in the 20th century is the writing for the orchestra in a chamber music fashion. This is in stark contrast to the late romantic, massive, lush, swooning, bigger the better orchestral sound dominant at the beginning of the last century, even in some of Schoenberg's own earlier pieces. Now, Mahler always used a very big orchestra, but he often used his large orchestra in a chamber-like way, it has to be admitted. But Schoenberg's first chamber symphony, written solely for 15 players, would have a huge influence on orchestral writing for the rest of the century. The no beating about the bush ending of the piece that we have just heard also seems to me like a rejection of the tediously drawn out ad infinitum smugly self-satisfied resolutions of so many symphonies of the time and throughout the 19th century. It seems for Schoenberg that from now on any note that couldn't be justified on purely musical grounds lost its right to be part of the score. This is also a beginning because Schoenberg said that it was in this piece that he first really found himself and a way to go forward. And forward he went, full steam ahead. Meanwhile, in New England, Now, that's a piece written by Charles Ives in the same summer of 1906. It's a piece called Over the Pavements, and it's also called, it's called a scherzo. Now, scherzo is a traditional, well, for a long time had been a traditional, well, since Beethoven anyway, had been a traditional movement in traditional four movement symphonies. A scherzo, literally, in the Italian, means joke. So I don't know if Charles Ives is having a laugh here. I don't know. Ives, I think, had a very deep sense of humor, but I don't know. But the most remarkable thing about this remarkable piece is almost certainly its rhythmic complexity. I won't get into too much detail here, but this piece, as I said, written in 1906, is an example of what's known as metric modulation. And by that, all I mean, it's a way of changing the tempo or the meter in the bars. For example, imagine you start off in 3-4 waltz time, you know, 1-2-3, 1-2-3, 1-2-3. And then you gradually but systematically change, let's say, from 3-4 to 6-8 or 11-8 or 9-8 or 11-16 or whatever you wish. And as I said, this is done in a gradual but systematic process. And Ives in this piece, the changes in the bars here is extraordinarily complex, and I imagine immensely difficult for a conductor to get several musicians to play this together without falling apart, because playing in different rhythms is a very complex thing. We just naturally tend to follow each other and follow the same rhythm. But this metric modulation, it's something that's very often credited to Elliot Carter, particularly when he started composing his mature pieces in the 1950s, starting with his spectacular first string quartet, which was finished in 1951. But again, as I said, I don't like repeating myself, but this was written in 1906, and extraordinarily brave, radical thinking on the part of Charles Ives. But that's what Charles Ives was all about. So I think that's all I have time for this week. It was quite a lot with Schoenberg's First Chamber Symphony, which is deserved, I think. And so I'll leave it there. So I'll say thank you again for listening. I hope you enjoyed, or at least were interested in something you heard there today. And if so, please keep tuning in for those resounding echoes.